reactive. Become proactive in designing those sinks so you can maximize the benefits that you can get from those plans.
Residents in the Kotzebue region weigh in on a plan for a road to Ambler. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an uptick in frostbite problems for Denali climbers.
No picture up high with a flag is worth losing fingers, losing toes, or losing parts of your body for.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack and stroke, miscarriage and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska health officials say Alaska Seafood has no radiation contamination from Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant, which was damaged by a tsunami in 2011. Officials from the Alaska Departments of Environmental Conservation and Health and Social Services announced results of U.S. Food and Drug Administration tests today. The FDA monitors radiation in both domestic and imported food. Alaska officials called for specific Alaska samples, including fish that migrate from Western Pacific waters off Japan. The federal agency tested samples from the Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands to Southeast Alaska. How will small Native communities in rural Alaska balance traditional life with the pressures of modernization? That was the question community leaders focused on during the second day of discussions on the proposed road to the Ambler Mining District. KNOM's Zechariah Hughes was in Kotzebue for the meetings and has the story.
For nearly 5 hours, in a conference room at the Nalogvik Hotel, representatives, many of them elders, from communities in the Lower Kobuk Valley, Koyukuk River, and elsewhere, shared their thoughts.
I think we have to seriously look at what we're doing right now, because we need a cash economy to support our way of life. I don't think we could go back to where we started from.
Like many others, Larry Westlake of Kiana shared his personal history before offering thoughts on how people in the Northwest Arctic and interior regions need to engage with development projects like the Ambler Industrial Road. The session was scheduled to be a dialogue between community members and state officials, but speakers chose to deviate from that plan and pass the microphone all the way around a large circle of about 30, each person getting her or his chance to talk. Walter Sampson lives in Kotzebue, and like many others, he used the road as a proxy for a larger conversation about how to affect change.
For too long, we've been planned for. It's time that we turn things around to where we plan our destiny, the future of our children and our grandchildren. Quit reacting. Become proactive in designing those things so you can maximize the benefits that you can get from those plans.
There were a lot of references to the need to prepare new opportunities, citing Red Dog Mine and the Ada-owned road connecting to it as a template for bringing the benefits of industrial mining back to shareholders. There was a lot of praise for Ada and their contractor, Dow HKM, who organized and paid for Wednesday and Thursday's meetings. Karsten Rodvik is in charge of external affairs for Ada and thought Thursday's session was a resounding success.
And clearly, there is a recognition for the sake of future generations that responsible development of Alaska's resources needs to occur today. I'm very pleased with the level of support that was expressed here today for this project and for the process going forward.
But some in attendance were unsure of what was accomplished. No decisions were made and few questions about serious selling points for the project, like the promise of jobs, lower costs of living, revenues, were answered. Jill Yordi is an environmental advocate who's followed the project closely and been to several meetings and says that while relationship building is important, decisions about fundamental features of the project keep getting deferred.
I think this is definitely a starting point. I think there's some conversation going on. I don't think it's anywhere near the full conversation that should happen. There's many people that are not at the table today that should be. Ada hasn't really been clear on what role these meetings are playing and how they're taking the information that people bring into account, how they're making those decisions.
Ada says that many of those specific decisions can't be considered until after the environmental impact statement has collected all the pertinent information. Mark Davis is a deputy director with the agency and says the upcoming EIS will set the stage for evaluating everything from subsistence impacts to financial models.
And that business plan would come after the EIS process. And then you'd make sure that business model could survive changes in the business environment, say a downturn in the price of copper, for example. And you'd make that decision then to determine whether the road would be viable given the size of those mines.
But there are those like Virginia Comack from Ambler who want local conditions put into writing before plans for the road go any further.
If anything is going to be beneficial to my people, there has to be memorandum of agreements before anything is really starting off, because EIS is going to be fast. Before we know it, it's going to be over. And by that time, things may change. So if anything's going to happen, it has to be before the EIS.
Those memorandums, or the requests they might protect, weren't really discussed. During the 2 days of meetings, there were times when it felt like two conversations were going on in the same conference room. Leaders from the Kobuk and Koyukuk River communities shared their personal perspectives how they might not just survive, but thrive. And representatives from the state listened and, in their turn, explained procedural steps and timelines for a template they say has worked before and will here. In Kotzebue, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
For the second time in 6 months, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill aimed at greater oil industry access to the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The bill would force the federal government to scrap its current management plan for NPRA and start over. It would also require additional lease sales there and offshore. It's supported by Alaska Congressman Don Young and passed the House yesterday as part of a larger GOP energy bill, largely along party lines. In November, the House passed a similar NPRA provision in a different GOP energy bill. Senate leaders have shown no interest in moving it. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the frustrations of ordering a fishnet.
And I'm still waiting. It's been a week. And I know there was fishing yesterday, and I was so depressed. I don't have anything hanging.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
All three candidates vying for the Republican nomination in August's U.S. Senate primary election squared off over a variety of issues in Anchorage yesterday. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
U.S. Senate Republican candidates Joe Miller, Dan Sullivan, and Meade Treadwell faced a crowd of well over 200 people in the East High School auditorium. Treadwell took shots at the amount of money coming into Sullivan's campaign from outside of Alaska. Sullivan countered by questioning Treadwell's fundraising activities, which Treadwell responded to with a sense of levity.
Can you give us a number of how many of those fundraisers you had in 2013? And were you traveling on the state's dime when you went to these numerous fundraisers in the lower 48?
Thanks, Dan. I'm glad you're so concerned about outside money.
Sullivan, who has raised far more money than his opponents to date, countered, again bringing Treadwell's fundraising methods into question.
We have been outraising any of my opponents. And if you take away the self-financing that you're doing with regard to your candidacy, looking in the mirror and asking yourself for a loan, we're almost outraising both of you together with Alaskans, grassroots Alaskans.
Sullivan also said Alaskans need a doer in Washington, D.C., not a talker. And Miller questioned which of those groups Sullivan would fall into.
What we don't need is somebody that claims to be a fighter, but behind him is being funded by Karl Rove, who is behind the very things that are destroying this country.
As the candidates addressed a variety of other issues, ranging from the IRS and foreign policy to abortion and gay rights, natural resource development and federal overreach remained a common thread throughout the conversation. When asked what the number one impediment to natural resource development is, Miller said it's compromise and, quote, environmentalism run amok. He went on to quote Kentucky Republican Rand Paul.
EPA regulations cost more than 5% of our annual gross domestic product, the equivalent of the cost of defense and homeland security combined. Since EPA regulations have expanded, unemployment in America has increased by 33%. This abuse of power by the implementation of regulations infringes upon our basic constitutional rights.
Miller followed up by saying bold actions such as scaling back or abolishing the EPA would be necessary. Treadwell says the biggest issue in resource development is access.
We have physical access. We need ports. We need roads. We need railroads. We need pipelines. And those are things that will make our natural resources go to market.
Sullivan says federal overreach isn't just the primary obstacle to natural resource development in the state, but to a plethora of other industries as well.
I used to think it was just in the resource sector. It is everywhere. Tourism, financial industry, fishing, small businesses, big businesses. There is hardly an Alaskan that I have met on the campaign trail that does not have some story about federal overreach.
The debate was organized by the Anchorage Republican Women's Club in conjunction with radio stations KOAN and KVNT. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
It's been a tough year for climbers attempting to summit Denali. Only 1 in 3 have made the summit. The weather also means higher risk for injuries, especially frostbite, as Philip Manning at member station KTNA explains.
High winds, snow, and narrow weather windows have been the story of climbing season thus far. One of the dangers that comes along with a windy season is frostbite, as mountaineering ranger Dave Weber explains.
I think especially this season, the high winds that have been associated with many of these weather events we've had have contributed to quite a bit of frostbite, much more than normal.
The number of instances of severe frostbite is up from last year. Dave Weber says that climbers headed for Denali are bombarded with messages about frostbite prevention. In temperatures well below zero, even relatively mild winds can contribute to frostbite. Dave Weber says that it doesn't take much skin exposure under those conditions to put life, and particularly limb, at risk.
We hear just yesterday stories of people exposing their hands for 10 or 15 seconds and becoming severely frostbitten, and that's a life-altering injury for some people.
Dave Weber says that medical treatment of severe frostbite is improving among doctors who specialize in the field, but many cases still result in amputation of the affected digit or limb. While Weber says he's had instances of cold hands and feet himself, he's never had a case of frostbite. He says that many cases of frostbite come about when climbers try to push through, even when the weather's bad. His message to mountaineers is simple.
No picture up high with a flag is worth losing fingers, losing toes, or losing parts of your body for.
While climbing season is slowing down, there are still hundreds of climbs to be completed. Thus far, the weather has meant the lowest summit percentage since 1987, in addition to the increase in frostbite cases. Reporting from Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Fish camp is an annual tradition going back thousands of years for Yupik people living along the Kuskokwim River. But fishing restrictions this year have hit many families hard. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Ayanna Dole prepares to visit fish camps downriver from Bethel.
We're going downriver to the native village of Nabuskiak, and they rely heavily on the salmon and hopefully they're getting their needs met. And that's what we're gonna go find out.
The 28-year-old Alaska native is a fisheries technician for Bethel's tribe, ONC. He asks people about their subsistence needs and run timings for kings, chums, and sockeye salmon. The information Dole gathers is reported to the Kuskokwim Salmon Working Group, which is helping federal and state biologists manage the fishery. This year, they say surveys are hard to get because people are angry about restrictions. Many won't talk with them. Just outside Nabuskiak at a simple camp with alder drying racks, Elder Sophie Jenkins agrees to take a survey. She says restrictions are traumatizing.
I looked at genocide and it says like this. People make policies and where people have no say with the law, with the policies and rules and regulations.
And how does that make you feel?
I'm very familiar with oppression and, you know, trauma. And that's how I feel right now.
After 2013 showed the weakest king salmon run on record, managers of the Kuskokwim River fishery are not allowing directed king salmon fishing. That means the 8-inch mesh nets that were introduced by the commercial fishery in the 50s and 60s and have become commonplace in YK Delta households have been banned completely. Instead, fishers have been limited to short, 4-inch mesh set nets. They're much less productive, and many fishermen don't own them. Some say purchasing the net is too expensive. Now it's late in the fishing season, and managers have been allowing short openings with 6-inch gear for chum and sockeye salmon. Jenkins ordered the 6-inch net, but she says she couldn't find one in Alaska. They were sold out, so she ordered one from a company in Tennessee.
And I'm still waiting. It's been a week. And I know there was fishing yesterday, and I was so depressed. I don't have anything hanging.
Residents along the Kuskokwim say the restrictions have created haves and have-nots. In nearby Oscarville Slough, Arvin Dull, the uncle of the fisheries technician, is having better luck. His fish rack and smokehouse are full of glistening red salmon. A former bank manager from Bethel, Dull had the cash to buy the net required this year.
It seems over the last 5 years, maybe every year, it seems like they changed the mesh size on us, and everybody had to invest more money. And a lot of people don't have jobs, and we're unable to buy the nets. Some people still can't afford even a 60-foot long whitefish net.
And how much does a net like that cost?
About $300.
His nephew says he sees why people are upset, but he also worries about extinction.
They'd like to open the big king net gear so they can target more kings and get more kings on the rack. You know, they're so used to seeing the fisher turn that they think no matter how hard they fish that they'll always come back, but that's not true.
At the time this story was filed, Elder Sophie Jenkins was still waiting for her net to arrive. If it comes in time, she says she hopes to get some fish on her rack. She says getting chum and reds is good, but they miss their kings. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Fire danger is up in southwest Alaska. Mike Ruse, a fire management officer with the Alaska Division of Forestry, says fuels, especially tundra grasses, are drying out.
They're very susceptible to starts from either lightning strikes or escaped burns such as dumps. And we've had two escape dump fires in the past 3 days, one at Mountain Village on the Yukon and one at Tuxuk Bay.
Smoke jumper crews were deployed to both fires. Clear, sunny weather and high winds are forecast through the weekend.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Jeremy Shea. This week on AK, dance. Although the ancient form of dance called English Morris was born so long ago its origins are murky, it remains alive and well, even in frozen Alaska. Rant and Raven, Anchorage's Morris Dance Group, is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year with a tour on the Alaska Marine Highway. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
On a drizzly evening, a half dozen adults are gathered inside a tiny apartment. Feet stomping on the wooden floor, they jump and twirl, brandishing wooden staves, the bells strapped to their legs all a jingle. Don't be alarmed. Dawn Berg and her team are only rehearsing their Morris dance moves.
Morris dancing really is
sort of a form of street theater. We probably are one of the shyest Morris dance groups in the world when it comes to being exhibitionists.
In England, Morris dance groups dress in raggedy costumes and traditionally perform outside pubs on holidays or anywhere just for the fun of it. The earliest English language reference to Morris dancing has been traced to 1448, when records show a trade guild paid dancers to perform. The dance may have had its origins outside England. It is thought that the word Morris could have come from Moorish. The clashing of the wooden staves as part of the dance leads some to believe that the original dance was a pantomime of conflict between Christians and Moors during medieval times. The dance became so popular in the 1500s that one contemporary of Shakespeare gained notoriety for dancing all the way from London to Norwich. That's about 100 miles. William Kemp wrote a book about his dance trip, and Rant and Raven is going to bring Morris dance by ferry boat from Bellingham to Yakutat. Two decades ago, Berg founded the group on her return from school in England, fittingly enough at the foot of the Captain Cook statue in Anchorage.
So I came back and really missed that culture when I came home and kind of met up with Scottish dancers and Irish dancers and all different kinds of people here. And one day we were at the Captain Cook statue and somebody started playing Maid of the Mill, which was a dance that I had danced in England, and I started to dance along, and we got to having a conversation about, wouldn't it be fun to start a Morris dance group and take it to the Renaissance Fair? And that's kind of how it all started.
Rant and Raven dances to simple concertina accompaniment, sometimes to only their own singing. Although the art form is ancient, it is plastic enough to allow new dances to be choreographed. Berg says it is difficult to maintain a team, or side, as they call it in Morris speak, unless new members are recruited from time to time. Longevity is Rant and Raven's strong suit, though, and they have arranged their own dances, too.
We've actually gotten quite a few of our dances off the internet. We've made up a couple of our own dances over the years. And one of them we call Raven's Nest, and that incorporates the Northwest-style rant step and the movements of ravens to have our own signature dance. Another dance that we made up was one that we call Domino 5, and we actually took a Scottish country dance, and we reworked a lot of the figures into something that would be an actual Morris dance. And what's exciting about that dance is we actually took that to Portland and taught that. We taught it to Renegade Rose Morris. And they're now doing that dance.
In South Australia I was born, even way humbly. South Australia, round shape, onward bound for South Australia.
Berg says Morris dancing's ability to evolve and change has helped it to survive into the 21st century. A Harper Touring Arts grant from the Rasmussen Foundation will help pay transportation costs when Rant and Raven, along with three other invited Morris teams, perform in Ketchikan, Juneau, and Yakutat during ferry stops. They will bring their show to Palmer on June 27th and to Anchorage on June 28th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Eagle, a small community on the Yukon River.
My name is Jason Hamilton. I live in Eagle. Eagle's a historic community. Originally, it was a native village in this area with the Han Athabascan. Then in the early 1900s, it was a gold rush community, and at one point had 1,700 people here and a U.S. military fort, and now it's a quiet little city of, I think, 85 people with a native village about 7 miles upriver towards the Canadian border from here, bringing the whole area total to about 150. Eagle's on the outside bend of the Yukon River, the end of the Taylor Highway. Looking across the river, you see Canada and the Ogilvie Mountains. There's Eagle's Bluff right next to it. It's basically a bush community.
I've traveled internationally. I grew up here. I've been on the Amazon River in a boat. Quite frankly, I can tell you that I've been places as pretty, but no place more beautiful than Eagle. The Native American word, the Athabascan word, for themselves is the people of the river, and that continues to be the case. The river kind of dominates life here. In 2009, it nearly destroyed the town and was rebuilt. The town was rebuilt. The people here are friendly. There was a description given of them by the head of the preserve that Eagle's a friendly town. If I go out to the store and see somebody, I'll wave at them, and maybe then I'll go up to the well house because most people don't have running water here to get water. And if I see the same person, I'll wave again. And then if I come back and I go to the laundromat, I'll wave again. If one of those times I forget to wave at the same person that I have seen every 15 to 20 minutes, there's a good chance when I get home they'll call and say, hey, are you upset with me about something? But mostly it's a sleepy town. It's got a bit of a tourism base because of the historic value. I could see myself living here for a long time. Happy to stay. It's much safer for my children than any other place that we've lived.
Jason Hamilton lives in Eagle, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, email news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ellen Lockyer, Sean Carpenter, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Kotzebue, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Jeremy Shea was our AK guest host this week. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Standdown event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.